The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Innovation races never stay won. You know, it was a blink of the eye between the United States deploying atomic weapons in Japan to the Russians testing one. There's no example, really, of a technology that you can keep in a test tube or in a safe for very long. So what that says is, you know, look, yes, do what you need to do to make sure that you are either, quote, winning or a very fast follower, but acknowledge that technology disperses. And that points you in a really important but eyes glaze over conversation, which is you've got to start putting in places the protocols and the conventions and the agreements and the norms that talk about how we use that technology. So it's a false belief that we can win and everything will be good. We do want to be up there. We want to be at the top of the race, but we also need to do something we haven't done in 4 years, which is devote time and energy to thinking about a world where these technologies are dispersed and what kind of rules and norms we want in that world.
I'm Susan Hennessy, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 26th, 2020. This month, the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence Subcommittee on Strategic Technologies and Advanced Research released a report entitled Rightly Scaled, Carefully Open, Infinitely Agile, Reconfiguring to Win the Innovation Race in the Intelligence Community. I sat down with Subcommittee Chair Congressman Jim Himes of Connecticut to discuss the challenges the United States is facing with near-peer national competitors in science and technology and the impact on the intelligence community. We talked about the role of China, stemming intelligence community brain drain, the need for basic research, and how Congress can heal itself to become part of the solution. It's the Lawfare Podcast, October 26th. Congressman Jim Himes on the intelligence innovation race. So, Congressman Himes, we're supposed to be talking about your HPSI subcommittee report on innovation in the intelligence community, which is a really interesting document that I'm excited to sort of dive deep into. But before we get to the report itself, I think it's worth sort of starting at a much higher level and giving listeners just a little bit of a sense of the purpose of congressional oversight of the intelligence community. So people think about investigations and hearings and kind of the political theatrics of it, but I think it's a little bit less visible, the nuts and bolts and sort of stewardship and policy role that underlies committee work and ultimately leads to sort of reports like this. So I'm hoping you might start us off by sort of walking through sort of what your view of intelligence committee oversight really is.
Yeah, thank you, Susan. Great question. I mean, it's really at the heart of what we do on the two intelligence committees, House and Senate. As many listeners will know, this grew out of some of the reforms that were made in the 1970s when I think, you know, we realized a couple of things. One, that intelligence was going to be an ever larger part of the nation's strategic arsenal. And we, I think, particularly after the Nixon years, became conscious of the fact that intelligence is awkward in a democracy. And what I mean by that, of course, is that by definition, almost everything that the intelligence community does is secret. And the premise of democracy, of course, is that citizens know what their government is doing and make judgments accordingly. And in this case, what the government is doing, as I often tell my constituents, is tense stuff, right? The intelligence community takes lethal action. The intelligence community surveils people, hopefully not American people, but there are obviously lots and lots of shades of gray in how it operates. And so since the whole world can't watch what the IC is doing in that regard, and you know, you don't have the scrutiny of the mainstream media, you don't have the scrutiny of the average hobbyist out there, a number of members of Congress, presumably trustable members of Congress, are asked to be read in to all of these activities. And since we live at the nexus of what the government is doing and what the people, as we sort of perceive it, want, our job is to kind of keep an eye on all of those activities and to raise red flags if we believe things are happening that are inconsistent with, you know, the values or the desires of our constituents and, more broadly speaking, the American people.
Yeah, so this is a massive job, right? Sort of these handful of members, a handful of staffers that stand in the shoes of the American public and have to oversee this sort of massive bureaucracy, sort of the numerous agencies, this really sprawling and in some cases overlapping intelligence communities. And so the question of how Congress organizes itself is really an important and interesting one. You know, my understanding is that in the past year, HPSI has itself undergone some sort of organizational and structural changes.
You're right. You're right on both counts. Oversight in any area is really hard. It's particularly hard in the intelligence arena because the nuts and bolts of intelligence are, in many instances, highly technical. If you're talking about, you know, technical collection means, if you're talking about satellites and bugs that get placed in vases of flowers and that sort of thing, it can be very technical. It can be very, very technically and esoteric legally, and not all of us are lawyers. And then you've got the traditional issue of sort of regulatory capture. You know, the reality is that you get to know the people who you are supposed to be overseeing. And, you know, these are good people. They're enormously, by and large, enormously patriotic, hugely capable people. And it's sort of hard not to develop a real sense of respect. I'll tell you, in intelligence, too, I smile when I say this, but I believe it to my core. You know, with intelligence, there's also the little boy factor, you know, which is that, you know, the intelligence community, believe me, they know about this. They come in and they show you a whole bunch of videos and they show you some of the tools they use and some of the nifty, you know, technology, and all you're left thinking is, oh my God, that's so cool. And of course, that's inimical. As fun as that is, that's inimical to the idea of being a good overseer. And so I have to kind of constantly remind myself, in the face of all of those issues, that good oversight means maintaining sort of a posture of informed skepticism to do this right. But you're right on your second point as well. So the House Intelligence Committee reorganized itself at the start of this Congress to not be agency oriented. We used to have a CIA subcommittee, an NSA subcommittee, a DIA subcommittee, and it's still very much a trial run, but now we're organized more along functional and conceptual lines. So the subcommittee I chair, of course, is Strategic Technology and Advanced Research, and NSA has a lot to do with that. You know, there are other subcommittees that sort of oversee more conceptual issues. So, you know, we're sort of trying to evolve to see what works best in terms of, as you put it, a very, very challenging oversight task.
One thing that's sort of really fascinating in reading the report is the extent to which that the new approach and sort of a cross-functional approach really comes through, rather than a traditional and really more familiar kind of agency-based approach. Talk us through sort of what was the understanding of the problem set whenever you sort of tasked this report out. Kind of what was your vision of what this report was intended to do?
Yeah, so this report was really designed to be an insider's look at how well we're doing and what we could do better in the realm of technological innovation. And that means at least two things. Number one, it means we don't want to be caught with our pants down around the development of some form of technology that could give a competitor or an antagonist a strategic edge. And the report talks about, you know, the fact that in particular, the Chinese have really committed to research in quantum computing. If you want, we can get into that. It's a very technical field, but it theoretically means that if somebody develops a functional quantum computer, that there would be no code out there that couldn't be cracked. And that doesn't just mean you're in my personal information. It means the nuclear command and control structure of the United States of America. But of course, that's just one area. Biosynthesis, you know, where now scientists can basically make up new animals from scratch the way they write software. that is scary enough in and of itself. But what about if that, you know, is a virus that is targeted at our service members? Or what about if you could develop an organic substance that could travel, you know, on an insect, but that could, you know, store 2 hours of video? You know, it's all a little bit Buck Rogers or science fiction-ish, but we have always, since World War II, been at the forefront of technological innovation, and that's been a big part of what's kept this country safe and prosperous. And the reality is that we now have what they call near peers, particularly in the form of the Chinese, and we really need to grapple with how we handle the fact that, you know, after 75 years or so of leading technologically, it's not clear that we're going to be the winner on all of these technologies.
So you've just laid out kind of a laundry list of game-changing technologies, AI, quantum, the report really starts to dig into. I do sort of wonder, right, if everything is important, then nothing is important. And so of sort of these lists of critical and transformative technologies, all of which I think, you know, there's a plausible argument to be made that this, you know, one area sort of is the essential thing we should be focused on. You know, do you have a sense as you look over this list of, look, this is the area of technical innovation where if we don't win this, then the rest just doesn't matter. You know, this is the area where we should be placing, you know, big bets, big investments, sort of in a resource constrained environment, kind of the which of these things, you know, keeps you up at night the most?
Yeah. I'm going to object to this form of the question a little bit because you know, in those three particular areas that we've talked about, and there might be a few others, I really would not want to say, well, so long as we're okay on biosynthesis, if we fail to develop a quantum computer, well, that wouldn't be so bad. You know, the truth is that at least in those three areas, you don't ever want to be surprised by your antagonist with a capability that you have no idea how to counter in any one of those three. The way I wouldn't object to the question, the form of the question would be to say the approach that we have to take in each of those, let's just stick with those. There are probably other ones too. You know, you could get into, you know, cold fusion maybe, but that gets sort of far afield of the intelligence community. You have to take very different approaches to those three areas. Let me give you an example. If you Google quantum computing, not something that most Americans are super familiar with, you pretty quickly become aware of the fact that in order to develop a functional quantum computer, you know, you need to chill substances, matters down to absolute zero. You need to be able to hold on to quanta, you know, photons and such, and you know, keep them from being influenced by outside signals. Needless to say, that's not something you're doing in your basement. Whereas artificial intelligence is a much less focused, much less high capital, much less esoteric thing. The truth is there are plenty of teenagers right now working with AI in their basements. And in that area, we just need to, I think, not necessarily do the kind of super targeted big investments that we would do to make sure that we lead on quantum computing. I think if, you know, the government there just needs to be at the forefront of understanding all of the different applications, you know, knowing what scientists and theoreticians are doing what around the world, because we're not likely to get surprised in a, you know, enduring and catastrophic way by something that happened deep in a basement lab somewhere. So the approaches are different. Biosynthesis, by the way, is probably somewhere in the middle. You know, there's nothing, you know, hugely challenging about a CRISPR machine, which is, you know, gene editing. So it's not quantum computing, but it's also, again, not every teenager is going to have a CRISPR machine in the garage.
Yeah, so just to offer another objectionably framed sort of question, how should we be thinking about, right, you've sort of talked about the difference between things that are important and things that are urgent and how sort of the long-term, you know, important issues a lot of times fail to get attention because there are so many urgent matters. There's also sort of a tension between the kind of long-term research and development issues that you're talking about now and sort of the smaller incremental developments that we might think about sort of maybe emerging organically from longer-term research. How do you sort of reconcile those things? How should we be thinking about balancing the need to invest in important long-term events on the, 10 and 20 and 50 year horizon against the really urgent things that are happening right now?
Yeah, great question. And you're right. The report worries a lot about that, right? I could say a bunch of things that would not create a sense of urgency on your part. Maybe you're not the best example because you know what happens on the inside. But, if I talk about the need to invest in, STEM education and the need to close the trust gap between Silicon Valley and the intelligence community, none of that sounds like house on fire kind of stuff, right? And if I start telling you the stories, I mean, in order to get your attention as your average person out there, I do need to tell a story like, quantum computing, now all of a sudden none of our nuclear codes are safe. You need to paint the almost Hollywood-esque picture of what the downside is. And by the way, that's why we did it right in the first place, right? We kicked this all off because, thank goodness, Albert Einstein and a bunch of other scientists, when the Germans were making tremendous progress in terms of splitting the atom in Nazi Germany, Albert Einstein, as we talk about in the report, wrote a letter to Franklin Delano Roosevelt and said, let me describe for you what this whole new world looks like. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt took it seriously, established the Manhattan Project. And we've had other episodes like that. But it all sort of points back to the need for some sense of maybe existential danger, right? The Sputnik moment, when Americans in their backyards grilling burgers and dogs could look up and actually see a Soviet spacecraft over their house. Boom! All of a sudden, that is a sense of urgency. That's a little hard to develop today because the existential threat is probably a little further down the road. You can't go out in your backyard and see something, partly because we are in a unique moment where one of our two parties, and maybe I should focus my comments on the president here, has zero interest in science or facts or fact-based ways of doing things. And then it's always a challenge, right? I mean, one of the key conclusions of the report is that one of the critical aspects of making our intelligence community agile is to probably increase the level of openness. Openness to bringing in people, technologists and entrepreneurs from Silicon Valley. By the way, openness, go out there and meet a dozen Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, seven of them will not have been born in the country. That's a huge issue for the intelligence community. It's probably a silly issue, Do we really believe that recent immigrants are more likely to betray this country than not so recent immigrants? So the point I'm trying to make, of course, is that a lot of the things that we need to do to really jumpstart our innovative effort here are somewhere on the spectrum of not urgent in people's perceptions and challenging because they sort of challenge the orthodoxy of the culture and the procedures of the intelligence community.
So this is a report that is about the innovation race in the intelligence community. For, I think, all of the technologies we've discussed thus far, there's a, sort of other areas, the defense industry, health industry, climate research, right? There are other areas that I think could sort of claim these technologies as well. And so, how should we be thinking about innovation issues in an intelligence-specific way? How do we sort of conceptualize the universe of intelligence innovation as something that's distinct from everything else, understanding that there is overlap? And are there places where that specific intelligence perspective you think sort of brings a real advantage and allows us to make more progress?
Well, the good news is the answer is there is no distinction, right? And this has been true of American innovation and government involvement in the basic research that leads to innovation from moment one, right? Most Americans will recognize the word DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Out of DARPA research, of course, came stuff that is now deeply embedded in Americans' lives, including the internet. And so there really is no line there. If you get the basic research that leads to innovation in the IC done, the spinoffs in that technology has applications everywhere. There really aren't any counterexamples. I mean, the Manhattan Project, of course, was designed to develop a nuclear weapon. Out of that comes nuclear power. It's a scary thing, of course, but, we're generating whatever we do, 20% of our power here in this country through nuclear power. And then there's the story of Tang and Velcro and all of these other things that came out of innovations that at some point were funded by the federal government, probably for a national security, but also maybe for a more energy-oriented type pursuit. But this is why people should should be more open to this idea than they perhaps are naturally, because there really is no line. The dollar we spend to educate, you know, an innovator in artificial intelligence doesn't just pay out to the intelligence community. It pays out to our society as a whole.
Yeah, so one thing that you've spoken about in the past and is certainly in this report that sort of, I think, ties into those comments is this notion that we need a system that isn't just more agile, but also a system that is more tolerant of taking risk. I'm sort of curious, why do you think that's not the case now? And why do you think this emphasis on sort of a greater openness, a greater willingness to fail and to take big risks is something we should be focused on?
Yeah, you know, in both the realm of openness and risk, the default position of government is not a good one. You know, on openness to new ways of doing things, you know, one way to think about government, and it's, I don't think it's too cynical, but one way to think about government is that it's there to preserve legacy systems and processes. In fact, the fight on Capitol Hill, you know, I sometimes think it's actually not between Democrats and Republicans. It's between the left, which is hell-bent on preserving every aspect of legacy social programs like Medicare and Social Security and others, and the right, which is, just seems hell-bent on preserving the privileges and perks and tax breaks of extractive industries and agriculture. But nobody is saying, hey, let's do things different, because, you know, there's no political capital. Quite frankly, there are not a lot of equivalents of the major defense contractors who are making campaign contributions saying, let's do this radically differently. When you say, let's do it differently and be open to change in government, you're also saying, we're going to take someone's lunch away. And that lunch may be a contractor, that lunch may be a mid-range military officer. And that brings me to risk, right? Again, government is not good at risk. Why is that? You know, members of Congress like myself, we're running every 2 years. And so if we screw something up and there's a failure with my name attached to it, and let's remember that success has to include failure, because without risk, there is no success. And with risk, there is no absence of failure. So, you know, let's start with me. You know, if I screw something up and there's a project with my name on it and it fails, think Solyndra, by the way. We could talk more about that if you're interested. It becomes a huge political issue. What about the full-bird colonel in the Pentagon who's in charge of, you know, thinking about software? You know, there's that old saying, nobody ever got fired for hiring IBM in the commercial world. Well, in the defense contracting world, you're a colonel and you take a real risk on some Silicon Valley startup that has new and exciting technology, and it goes south, which it might. You can just count on the contractors and the senators and the members of Congress, you know, making it pretty unlikely that as a full bird colonel, you're going to be a flag officer down the road. It's hard, Susan. It's really, really hard, because neither of those concepts are natural to the federal government, but it's a huge liability that they are not. I think it's incumbent on us to think about how can we make the system more tolerant of risk? Because without risk, you are calcified. And if you're calcified, eventually you lose.
So you mentioned software in that answer. You know, one thing that really sort of jumped out at me is the kind of the proclamation here that the software development process in particular is broken, and that it is creating intolerable forms of risk, to use the same term. What is your sense of the nature of the current software development process, and why is it so concerning whenever we think about how it relates to kind of the core activity of the intelligence community in terms of, you know, collection, analysis, storage, things like that?
Yeah, so it is worth, and the report does this, it's worth thinking of software differently. And there's a couple of good reasons for that. Number one, this wasn't true 50 years ago or even 25 years ago, but today software is almost everything, right? Software, because all of our weapon systems, because our surveillance systems, criminy, because our, you know, automobiles and refrigerators are all wired together in ways that have, you know, hugely salutary benefits to us. Software is everything. I think it was Mark Andreessen we quote in the report who said software is eating everything. So it's everything. And the problem is the government, and definitely the Pentagon, by the way, to a lesser extent, the intelligence community. The Pentagon and the national security community generally thinks about software. Okay, I need to go buy some of that. right? But that, of course, and that's how they bought tanks, and that's how we bought satellites for the NRO. We go and we buy some of that. And so we get a bunch of very senior people together to say, we're going to take 6 months to write, you know, 70-page descriptions of what this thing needs to do. And then we're going to hand it into a defense contractor or to somebody and help us produce it, and we'll pay them, and boom, we're done. Well, that's not at all the way software works. You know, listeners will know that every single day, probably, their handheld cell phone, iPad, whatever they use, has their software updated. Because software is never done. It is an iterative development process in which it's very hard to, at the very beginning, have a list of firm criteria. What you want is you want constant interaction with the end user, and you want a living process in which, you know, new ideas are embraced, which takes us back to the risk conversation. And, you know, again, NSA has lived in a software world for a long time. So I would say that they're on the better end of this. You know, the Pentagon acquisition apparatus, which is about buying enormously expensive ships and airplanes, I would say they're on the other end of the spectrum. And we mentioned in the report, there's actually a terrific book about it by Christian Brose named The Kill Chain. He was John McCain's lead staffer on defense issues, and then I think chief of the staff on Senate Armed Services. And he makes this case that we really need to radically rethink the way the government does software. And by the way, sorry to make the answer longer than it should be. The good news is we are modeling that even inside the Pentagon with projects like Kessel Run, which is a little tiny corner of the Pentagon that is developing an esoteric piece of software to control the combat air operations centers, and in particular the one in Qatar, where we have a huge air base, in an iterative, flexible, your work is never done kind of way. But that is the dramatic exception to the rule in how the national security apparatus buys this essential, essential thing.
So I want to talk a little bit about China, because it seems to be sort of a source of tension in this report. You say that sort of it's an overly narrow view that the national security innovation race is framed as a competition with China. And while sort of acknowledging it's a significant competitor, really does sort of say that we should be thinking about this in much broader terms. That said, a lot of the sort of the meat of the recommendations, a lot of the specific applications, even of the conversation we've had thus far, does kind of lead back to China. And so I'm curious, you know, as we kind of conceptualize the world in which we are innovating, how should we be thinking about China as part of the sort of long-term strategic vision? And, you know, is thinking of China as a competitor unhealthy and sort of warps innovation and development? Or is it naive to not recognize, sort of this near peer as we now acknowledge that they are?
Well, I think thinking about China requires two counterintuitive leaps, right? The first one is, and this is true of thinking about China in every realm. You know, we humans like to think in, you know, terms of, you know, good, bad, black hat, white hat. China's an enemy. That's the language of Donald Trump, right? The reality is that that's not the right way to think about China, right? China does things and is things that are profoundly objectionable to us. And I'm talking about, you know, obviously the internment of a minority population in Western China. I'm talking about their stealing our intellectual property. I'm talking about their own human rights record inside. There's a long list of things that are beyond obnoxious to people with Western or American values, but they are also our absolutely essential economic trading partner. And not just economic trading partner, they own trillions of dollars of United States debt. And so, you know, we sort of need to think about China as something other than just a bad guy and a competitor. Now, in the more narrow realm that we're talking about here, yes, we really don't want the Chinese to develop a fully functional macro quantum computer before we do, because if they do that, they can break all of our codes. On the other hand, you know, they've got absolutely first-rate researchers in various academic institutions, and we should be, you know, sitting next to those guys drinking cups of coffee so that we know what they're doing, so that we're working together to, you know, to advance research in the kind of academic context that research does typically advance. And I think that's really important. The second thing that we've got that is counterintuitive is I really object to the framing of we need to win the race with China. As we point out in the report, innovation races never stay won. You know, it was a blink of the eye between the United States deploying atomic weapons in Japan to the Russians testing one. There's no example, really, of a technology that you can keep in a test tube or in a safe for very long. So what that says is, you know, look, yes, do what you need to do to make sure that you are either, quote, winning or a very fast follower, but acknowledge that technology disperses. And that points you in a really important but eyes glaze over a conversation, which is you've got to start putting in places the protocols and the conventions and the agreements and the norms that talk about how we use that technology. So it's a false belief that we can win and everything will be good. We do want to be up there. We want to be at the top of the race, but we also need to do something we haven't done in 4 years, which is devote time and energy to thinking about a world where these technologies are dispersed and what kind of rules and norms we want in that world.
So the report sort of lays out these kind of five areas, you know, sort of five places, you know, sort of ripe for reform to help sort of incentivize and support intelligence community innovation. And the very first thing on the list is funding and money. And it's not just an argument for more money, which is usually the case in reports like these. It's actually sort of a description of how the current funding landscape is actually inhibiting innovation. That's a little bit of an unusual argument coming out of Congress. And so what is it about sort of the current funding and procurements process and appropriations and authorizations process that you think is inhibiting innovation?
Yeah. Well, you know, you sort of touched on an interesting and sensitive aspect of the report, you know, and I think we use some language that maybe, you know, raises an eyebrow. You know, I've been doing this for 12 years now, and I've heard probably 10,000 different problems in my office. And without fail, the answer to all 10,000 of those problems is we just need more funding. And okay, that's not to say that that may not be true, but what else? What else? Particularly in a world of, you know, massive deficits and constrained spending, what else? Look, in this area, Susan, actually, the world is investing far more in basic research than it ever did before. The United States is investing a little bit less on a relative basis, not on an absolute basis, but on a relative basis, we're investing less as a percentage of our GDP. But you know what? We're investing a lot. So if you said, would it be better for the government to do more research, basic research in advanced energy technologies or quantum? Of course, the answer is yes. But if you live in an ecosystem where everyone else out there, and by everyone else out there, I'm talking about the Googles, I'm talking about the Facebooks, I'm talking about the Israelis and the Germans and the Brits, and maybe I'm even talking about the Chinese, where they're investing massive quantities of money. Part of the game, and maybe the essential part of the game, is not let's spend more money than they do. It's let's make sure that we, at a minimum, know what they're doing, and better yet, that we understand the applications and the implications of the research that they're doing.
So you describe these sort of these layers of bureaucracy that have cropped up over the past, you know, 4 and 5 decades that really end up inhibiting innovation and inhibiting all kinds of precisely the kinds of basic research that you're talking about right now. And just from the outside seem, you know, there's sort of a waste of time and energy. That said, a lot of sort of these bureaucratic layers, right, they didn't spring up in a cabbage patch. They were created as responses to concerns about sort of waste, fraud, and abuse. And so whenever we're thinking about mechanisms to kind of cut through some of the bureaucratic layers that inhibit innovation whenever it comes to money, how do we think about doing that in a way that still balances the need for transparent, accountable use of funds in the environment of sort of secrecy that you described just at the beginning of this conversation?
Yeah, great question. And I think the answer to it is that we need to be smart about what benefit bureaucracy and a more cumbersome process brings and what the risks are of a more, let's just say, you know, commercial, private sector, Silicon Valley type development process. So let me illustrate that with examples. There are good reasons for a lengthy process. Those reasons are making sure that if you produce a product, that it performs precisely as advertised. And if you're talking about things like, to give you an example, our ability to communicate with one of our intelligence officers who's undercover amongst, enemies in Peshawar or in Medellin, failure, which I was extolling previously, is never and will never be an option. So there are things that are so essential in their performance that maybe you say, well, you know, we need a process that makes failure, as they say, not an option. But that's actually the minority of things, right? That is the example I just gave you. That is, you know, the armor on a tank needs to perform exactly as advertised. And, you know, there are other examples. But my point is that the vast bulk of what we buy, you've got more room. You've got more room. You know, failure can be contained in a way that doesn't have lethal circumstances on our people. And so I think you need to be a little bit nuanced about acknowledging that, you know, you're not going to have an open, iterative, quick process for everything, but that you probably can for vast quantities of the stuff that the national security apparatus purchases that today is subject to that same old model.
So it's not just technology, it's people. And you're obviously concerned about the sort of the talent pipeline and personnel. The report really specifically expresses concerns about brain drain from my former agency at NSA. This is a really longstanding, really entrenched problem. How do we go about fixing it?
Well, the people problem is a big one, and it's got a lot of facets to it. So let's just talk about two or three of those facets. Number one, we need more cross-pollination between, you know, data scientists in Silicon Valley and at, the computer science lab at MIT and their equivalents inside NSA and inside the Pentagon. We just need to be more agile to take that individual who, and there's probably a lot of them. I know there are a lot of them, a data scientist, who's had one successful company and is really, really understand some esoteric field and just say, you know, that guy doesn't want to go and do a 30-year career at, and that guy or gal, I should say, doesn't want to go do a 30-year career at NSA. But what if you could set it up so that that person could go spend 2 or 3 years and bring that intellectual capital to the agency? That's a really good thing, but it's not part of the culture. It's not part of the hierarchy. And then, of course, we've got the whole clearance process, which is a hopefully improving disaster in as much as it can take 2, 3, 4 years to actually get somebody's security clearance. But it's that cross-pollination that's really important. People, it's also about retention. And that means that you're, you know, allowing people to be entrepreneurial and take risk. And by the way, to fail. Again, we keep coming back to this concept of failure. You know, there's a saying, at least where I used to work in the private sector, that if you're never failing, you're not taking nearly enough risk. And, you know, that's just not something that would be typical for a typical element of the culture that a mid-level person inside the Pentagon or inside the IC, or quite frankly, inside any part of the federal government will accept, because, you know, failure means that they are less likely to be promoted. So that's another facet of the people problem. And then, of course, this gets us into a whole big policy can of worms. But as I said before, go to a conference with the very best data scientists, the very best artificial intelligence theoreticians, you name it. I promise you that American citizens are probably going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% tops in the room. You know, we need to make sure that we get the very best talent on the planet in general, but in our national security apparatus in particular. And look, today, for a whole bunch of reasons that we don't need to get into, we're telling everybody everywhere around the world that we're just not interested in you. And that's a huge national security risk.
So what's the role of the private sector in all of this? Right? We've sort of talked about solutions that draw from both, encouraging innovation. Whenever you're talking about basic research, are we talking about the next Bell Labs? Are we talking about DARPA, things that sort of occur only within the government? Are we talking about removing barriers to innovation in the private sector? Right? Sort of, what do you view as the private sector's role in all of this?
So I don't know that government needs to focus too hard on removing barriers to innovation in the private sector. There are some things we could do, namely get the immigration situation right. Anytime someone from Silicon Valley or Boston or Austin comes into my office, that's the first thing they talk about. So there are things that we could do. But what I'm talking about more is that cross-pollination piece, right? You know, the next Bell Labs, there's 10 of them, right? One of them is Google. One of them is Facebook. There are a whole bunch of them out there. And I think we need to do one big thing, which is increase the level of understanding and cross-pollination, a word I keep using, between the Googles and the Facebooks and the other, you know, deep intel, you name it, researchers and government, at a minimum, so that our government people know what is going on out there in the private sector, that they know what the culture is out there in the private sector. And one of the things that we talk about in the report that I think we do need to do a better job, and I think this is incumbent on both the private sector and on the government, you know, you hear stories about, you know, Twitter deciding that they're going to not let Dataminr, which is a remarkable company doing remarkable things with public information, by the way, people's Twitter feeds, that Twitter's not going to let Dataminr work with the intelligence community, or the employees of Google object to Google participating in Defense Department projects. You'll never solve that problem completely, because the government will do things that others object to from time to time. But we don't do nearly enough work making sure that those engineers on Google's campus in California really understand what the government is doing, who government people are, that these are actually very good people who do their job, with great dedication. And by the way, part of their job is making sure that they comply with the law and the Constitution and our values. I do think we have a lot of work to do to close a little bit of that trust gap that is there. And that involves partly who they are, but it also involves making sure that our IC leadership is fairly regularly out in the private world, building relationships, participating in conferences, getting to know people, and helping to sort of educate other worlds in this sort of hermetic thing that they do.
So I don't want to miss the opportunity to beat up on Congress a little bit, in part because you have invited us to do so by putting sort of a section in your report about what Congress needs to do to fix itself and the ways in which the legislative branch itself is contributing to some of the dysfunction that you identify. So what is Congress getting wrong, and what do you guys need to do to get it right?
Yeah, we tried to make this fairly clear what we were after by entitling that little section, Congress, Heal Thyself. a lot of what Congress needs to do is implicit in what we've been talking about here. I've never had to do it from the other side of the dais, but I do know what it's like for those who are overseen, whether they're in the NSA or the Department of Commerce or at the FBI, to get grilled by Congress in hearings. That is not a happy moment for people. And so I think we have a lot of work to do on, not to beat a dead horse, but making sure that members of Congress and staff understand the virtues and importance of failure. And look, that's not all failure, right? Failure as a result of incompetence, of laziness, of there's lots of failures that are not okay. But when you take a calculated risk and that risk goes wrong, that's part of the process. So I think we can do that. Number two, Congress has a massive attention issue, and I'm not sure you can fix this problem, but, you know, a member of Congress will contemplate 20 different policy areas, you know, before lunchtime. And that doesn't lend itself to that member of Congress becoming deeply, deeply knowledgeable on, you know, how Bayesian algorithms are suddenly changing the way people think about artificial intelligence. I'm not sure how you fix that other than, you know, kind of turbocharge the fact that members of Congress do develop areas of expertise. Last point, I hear this, it was before my time, but the Office of Technology Assessment, which was a congressional creature that was designed to make sure that Congress had both expertise and access to really good thinking about technology. People who were around in that era, and that was the era when the internet was sort of exploding into our universe, they really mourn its passing. And they say Congress has made itself stupid by what I'm told was Newt Gingrich's decision to eliminate the Office of Technology Assessment. So, yeah. Look, at the end of the day, we're the Article I authority. So it always feels a little funny to me when we point our fingers at a whole bunch of other people and say it's your fault without starting. But, you know, what else? What should we do about it?
So to end on a high note, what are we getting right? You've done this sort of massive survey of these various mechanisms of innovation. What are the bright spots?
Yeah. So let me give you two or three. Number one, this is a little bit intelligence community specific, but we really, since 9/11, have done a tremendous job inside the intelligence community at breaking down the institutional barriers that used to exist. So I'm talking about what people call stovepipes. You know, apparently it used to be a big part of federal government culture that the FBI hated the CIA and the CIA hated the FBI and they didn't share information and that was all fun for everybody. Well, that's gone. And when I say gone, it's not that we've gotten it perfect, but our research led us to the conclusion that there is lots of flow of people, ideas, and information between the 17 different elements of the intelligence community. That's a real achievement. Number two, we have some examples of how you create a culture of innovation. And I talked about Kessel Run. Near as I can figure, what makes that happen is really visionary leaders. So Kessel Run is partly the product of Will Roper, you know, who is a civilian senior official inside the Department of Defense, you know, who was very motivated by one of our past secretaries of defense to think different, as if I may borrow the Apple motto, to think different. And when you have senior level sponsorship, you know, you get real results. Eric Schmidt, who's in the Defense Intelligence Board, he was the chairman for a while. He said, the Pentagon, the national security apparatus, doesn't have an innovation problem. It has an innovation adoption problem. And so when you do have leaders like Will Roper who push this stuff, we really succeed. The problem is we need a lot more Will Ropers across a lot more agencies.
Well, we will leave it at that. Congressman Jim Himes, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Susan.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Congressman Jim Himes for coming on the show. Please share the Lawfare podcast and give us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes or wherever you listen. The podcast is edited by Jen Pacha-Howell, and your audio engineer is Zachary Frank. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.